to thank Alice and more generally the Institute for giving me a chance to come back here. It's always very nice to visit PI. I'll be talking today mostly about results from a paper that we put on archive a couple months ago now with Amos Jerome and Natasha Pinzani-Fakeva on all things Schwinger-Keldysh. I should also say that our paper would not exist if it was not for previous work. Too many archive numbers to highlight, so let me just say who the authors are. The previous work that we're building upon is largely that of Pavel Kovtun and co-authors, as well as Hong Lu and Mukun Rangdamani and their respective co-authors. Now, after that, this talk begins, as far as I'm concerned anyway, with a little bit of personal history. So some years ago, after I had finished my PhD, I went to Victoria to start my first postdoc with Pavel Kovtun, who's in the audience. And as I was starting up, he got me interested in transport and hydrodynamics. And peering in both the low energy description of black brains in ADS-CFT, as well as in field theory at finite temperature more generally. And one of the things that I found very interesting and very appealing about hydrodynamics at the time as someone who was trained as a string theorist was two things, really. One, that it was sort of like current algebra. And the second was that it has a very broad range of applicability. I hope this colored chalk is a little bit more readable to those in the back than the white chalk was. Can you folks read this? Okay, good. The same theory of hydrodynamics appears in the low energy description of black brains and in water, which covers a pretty good parameter space of the space of quantum field theories. Now, when I say current algebra, what I mean is the following. When one works with hydrodynamics, one doesn't start with an action principle for some fields and then write down the analog of a partition function as an integral over fields. One doesn't have anything like this. What one has instead is constitutive relations. So one postulates some functional form for one-point function of conserved quantities. So one-point function of stress tensor, if you have a theory with a global symmetry, one-point function of conserved currents, in terms of some collective variables and their derivatives. So rather than enumerating an action in terms of degrees of freedom for the problem and writing down all the sort of terms that can appear order by order in gradients, what one does instead is one postulates some set of low energy variables and then expands out one point function of stress tensor, one point function of current in terms of those variables. So for instance, something that you may have seen before is diffusion. You can supply a constitutive relation for charge density, namely to say it's charge density, rho, and then supply an expression for current, vector current, namely that it's minus some diffusion constant, which depends on charge density, times spatial derivative of charge density, plus higher gradient corrections. In addition to supplying constitutive relations, one has to supply some principle that determines the low energy variables, namely, what one usually does is provide some classical equations of motion that determine, in this instance, rho. Those classical equations are nothing more than the conservation equations. Current is conserved, stress tensor is conserved. And that's enough to solve to give a well-defined classical system in terms of classical hydrodynamic variables up to initial and boundary conditions. Now, this description is, I've tried to sketch it out, it's also very useful from the point of view of quantum field theory, because what it does, well, let me phrase it this way. One can formulate hydro in the background of a slowly varying external metric and external gauge field, provided that they vary over arbitrarily long timescales. You can formulate hydro in external fields. And if you solve hydro equations in external fields and then plug the result back in to your current, what you end up getting are things like one-point function of current as a function of external field. And then you can take variational derivatives of that to get correlation functions in the low energy, low momentum regime. So, you know, for instance, taking a first derivative of this, setting A equals zero, spits out current two-point function at finite temperature and low energies. So in that sense, hydro, even though you don't have an action, you can really think of it as an effective description of thermal physics at low energies. It gives you a recipe for computing correlation functions. Now that's all well and good. But of course, in the textbook treatment of hydro, there's, well, thinking about it as a field theorist anyway, there's still a number of some things that are absent. One of which that would, of course, be nice to know is an action principle. Not unrelated to that is a good way to organize perturbation theory. You can think about it this way. So in hydrodynamics, one has various low energy degrees of freedom, gapless variables. And those low energy variables, of course, can run around in loops. You can ask, you know, what if I look at correlation functions and I want to see, you know, how do those gapless degrees of freedom contribute to loop corrections to correlation functions? Well, how do I even get started? Here, it's not clear. I just have one-point functions. If one had an action principle for hydro, a proper action principle with, you know, functional integral and everything, then that would tell you, you know, how one goes about and computes correlation functions in a good loop expansion, provided some small parameter exists that you can expand in. There's another sort of funny thing about hydro that some phenomenological consideration that hasn't been derived from first principles, really. And that's that one also demands, when constructing the effective hydro description, a local version of the second law of thermodynamics. So you demand that there's some current called an Entropy current that's also constructed from your variables, and you demand that it, in equilibrium, it's equal to entropy. So you demand that there's a current, S mu, that in equilibrium is your honest-to-God thermodynamic entropy density times your whatever is setting your equilibrium direction, 1, 0, plus gradient corrections. And that entropy current, at least for fluid flows that solve the equations of motion of the theory, that its divergence is positive semi-definite. You interpret this as a local version of the statement that entropy is always produced. Sort of physically, the motivation behind this statement goes back to the earlier in the 20th century, the idea being if you study very long wavelength fluid flows, well, you know entropy is going to be always increase globally, but if your fluid is in approximate thermal equilibrium everywhere, then you would want to say, oh, well, it increases in every little patch of your fluid. And it turns out this statement, well, it's interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that to date, it hasn't been derived from fundamental considerations in field theory. And second, well, and let me draw your attention to the fact this is not an equality, this is an inequality. It's very it's unusual in quantum field theory to derive inequalities rather than equalities. That's one reason why it's interesting. A second reason is that it appears to be true. If you construct hydrodynamic descriptions that don't respect this, then things inevitably go wrong. You violate unitarity, you have spectral functions that are negative at positive frequency, you violate causality, all sorts of horrible things happen. So it appears to be a correct statement, but it's unclear how one derives it from fundamental principles. Anyway, all these things been nagging features for a while now, at least to a string theorist when you look at hydro. And they all really come down to the absence of a proper effective action for the theory. And, well, that already is kind of interesting because, you know, if you talk about hydro, you're talking about quantum field theory at finite temperature, really. And if you want to talk about effective field theory at finite temperature, then you're dealing with effective field theory in a mixed state of quantum matter rather than in a pure state. So if you did want to really attack this problem of formulating an action principle for hydro, you would be led into a proper discussion of quantum field theory or effective field theory in mixed states. And whenever you talk about quantum field theory in mixed states, one walks right into what's called the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism. This is all to sort of get me started with the title of the talk. Why am I talking about Schwinger-Keldysh? Well, this is one reason. So this leads into Schwinger-Keldysh. If you've never seen Schwinger-Keldysh before, don't fear. I'm going to talk about it now. So starting now, I'm going to transition from saying general things about hydro to essentially enumerating the governing principles for effective field theory in the Schwinger-Keldysh setting. That's the goal, really, for the rest of this talk. So to start that off, I have to tell you what Schwinger-Keldysh is in the first place. Suppose that I have some quantum field theory, and I put it initially in a mixed state characterized by a density matrix. We call it rho minus infinity. So I'm putting it in a mixed state in the far past. Well, with a density matrix rather than a pure state, the analog of the vacuum-to-vacuum partition function, the simplest thing that I can build out of that state and time evolution, is what's called the Schwinger-Keldysh partition function. Let me call it Z. And what I do, if I have an initial state, mixed state, I can time evolve it with a time evolution operator from the infinite past to the infinite future. But actually, if I have a density matrix, well, should really have a U dagger to take me back from the infinite future back again to the infinite past, take a trace. But when I do this, I can time evolve and then anti-time evolve with different Hamiltonians, that is, by turning on different sources for operators in the theory. So I turn on some sources, let me call them collectively A1, as I time evolve into the future, but nothing stops me from turning on different sources when I go back in time. That is to say, the partition function depends really on two sets of sources for operators, not just one set of sources. Let me denote these guys rather than having brackets and A1s and A2s, let me just call them U1 and U2 dagger. So already we see one of the most visceral features of the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, which is doubling, or at least, you know, one has more than one set of sources. Now, if I have a theory with a Lagrangian description, if I have some Lagrangian, some action, then you can write down a functional integral representation for this partition function. To do it, I introduce a set of fields to represent the first time evolution operator, and then a second set of fields to represent the second one. So my, not only are my sources doubled in the partition function, but my functional integral is over two sets of fields. Let me collectively denote them as phi 1 and phi 2. And the action I integrate over is just the action my one fields with my one sources minus my action with my two fields, my two sources. The relative minus sign arises from the fact that my one fields appear in time evolution operator and my two fields appear in anti-time evolution operator. And I also got to supply boundary conditions. My fields phi 1 and phi 2 are identified in the infinite future. That's what the trace involves. And then in the past, they have some boundary conditions that are set by the initial state. So a picture that I can draw for this is that my initial state, let me just represent it as some blob. And thinking of going from right to left, I start off with my initial state. I time evolve into the future, and then I come back. Another way of saying this is that in this functional integral description, that's formulated on what's called a closed time path contour that has this shape. Okay. Good. So there's a couple of immediate features that pop out of doing Schwinger-Keldysh that are already somewhat different from normal quantum field theory that are worth mentioning. The first is the following. This partition function, if you take its complex conjugate, well, if I take complex conjugate of this, you know, that acts as Hermitian dagger inside the trace, so that transposes my operators, replaces. So I get U2 rho infinity, rho minus infinity. Density matrices are Hermitian. U1 dagger. Which is not the thing that I started with, nor its complex conjugate. It's just something else. That is to say, the act of complex conjugation amounts to flipping the sources, exchanging them. So you can think of it as complex conjugation sort of corresponds to reversing the time ordering along the Schwinger-Keldysh contour. Instead of going 1 to 2, I go 2 to 1. What this means in practice is that Z is complex. The partition function is complex. It's not. Correspondingly, the Wilsonian effective action below some scale can be complex, which is different from the usual case. In the usual setting, unitarity implies that the Wilsonian effective action for the vacuum to vacuum amplitude is real. In this setting, the effective action can be complex. The second thing that I want to draw your attention to is that in the ultraviolet, where one writes down, if you have a Lagrangian, one writes down a functional integral of this form, one has locality along the Schwinger-Keldysh contour. So in this action, fields here don't talk to fields directly on the two part of the contour. But if you look at the low energy effective action, renormalization group flow, will generate cross-contour couplings that allow fields here to talk to fields here. So in the low energy, so at high energies, you know, there's no terms that couple the two infinite segments of the contour, but then at low energies, those couplings will be generated. Yeah.
Can you explain a little more why you need two parts of the contour? So like, I assume you want to take derivatives with respect to the sources to evaluate things. So what I could have, what happens if you don't insert new sources like A2 or something? Why do you need both?
Why do you need both? Oh, why do I not just consider trace u rho minus infinity and then stop there?
Yeah, or trace the same sources. I mean, what are you going to compute that requires?
What is this good for?
Yeah. What are you trying to compute?
Good. Okay. Can I delay the answer to that question by 50 seconds?
Sure.
Maybe 1 minute?
Yeah.
Okay. So the only thing I want to say about these cross-contour couplings is that they're strongly constrained by symmetries, as we'll see. And in some sense, that's the point of this talk. Now, to answer that question, what is this thing good for? If you take functional variations with respect to the two different sources that I put in here, I can get correlation functions with many different time orderings. So far I've just advertised this is the simplest thing that you can build out of a density matrix and time evolution operators, but its variations encode many different types of correlators. So what kind do you get? Well, the kinds that you get involve expectation values of a string of anti-time ordered operators coming from functional variation of the U2 dagger, and then string of time-ordered operators coming from variations of the U. If I only had one U, then I would just say I only had U1, not U2 dagger, then I would only be able to compute time-ordered correlations. But having both allows me to get this larger family of correlation functions. In particular, at the level of two-point functions, there's three different kinds of two-point functions that one can define with different time orderings. There's retarded, there's advanced, and there's symmetrized. And they all follow from, how to say, as appropriate variations of Schwinger-Keldysh partition function. I should say retarded, advanced, symmetrized. To fill that out a little bit more, what one does is you make a change of basis, and rather than talking about one fields and one sources and two fields and two sources, you define average and difference. You define average and difference sources and operators. So you define phi r, phi 1 plus phi 2 over 2, phi a, phi 1 minus phi 2. You can do the same thing for sources. And if operator 1 is conjugate to A1 and operator 2 is conjugate to A2, then R-type operators are conjugate to A-type sources, and vice versa. So I'm saying something simple. If you have A1, O1 minus delta A2, O2, if that's your variation of your partition function, then you can rewrite this as delta A, R, O, A minus delta A, A, O, R, not minus with a plus. And then retarded is a variation of generating functional first with respect to an R-type source, and then with respect to an A-type source. And then advanced is the reverse. And symmetrized is second variation with respect to A-type sources. So all the different two-point functions that you would ever care about are encoded in this partition function with the two U's. That's one reason why you would study it. Okay. What else did I want to say? Oh, yeah. Now, another reason why you might care about this problem of Springer-Kalbisch effects in field theory is in the context of ADS-CFT. My understanding is that it's not completely settled how one ought to do real-time finite temperature ADS-CFT. There's a few different prescriptions that are on the market. The sort of standard one is due to Malvicena from the early 2000s to 2001 or so. And the statement, what he advocates is that, it's not quite Springer-Kalbisch, it's something that's very closely related called thermofield double. So the claim is that the thermofield double, it's of some theory with a gravity dual. The dual gravitational description of that state is a two-sided black hole. This Penrose diagram looks like this. So this is provided that your initial state is thermal. The thermofield double, if you really want to know how it differs from Springer-Kalbisch, when one considers correlation functions in Springer-Kalbisch in that expectation value, there's really a trace with an e to the minus b to h in front, and then string of anti-time ordered, string of time ordered. In thermofield double, what you have is instead trace e to the minus b to h by 2, anti-time ordered e to the minus b to h by 2, time ordered blah, blah, blah. And then the factors of e to the minus b to h by 2 correspond to boundary conditions in the past interior and the future interior. Anyway.
So this may be tangential.
Yeah.
So these correlation functions, they are measured.
Right.
Experimentally. These ones, the thermofield double ones, are those measured?
I can compute retarded advanced symmetries from things of this form. So yes. Anyway. Why did I invoke thermofield double in ADS-CFT? Well, drawing the picture is nice. Already you see the same feature of doubling that you see at the level of Springer-Kalbisch partition function. So an ADS geometry of this type has two asymptotically ADS boundaries. You can turn on sources on either of those two boundaries. If you will, there's your A1 and A2. It's also the case that the non-retarded observables, the ones that are not fully causal in Springer-Kalbisch or thermofield double, for instance, the symmetrized two-point function, those guys, they probe transhorizon physics. So if you're interested in physics behind a horizon, then, well, at least in the context of two-sided black holes, then you implicitly care about Springer-Kalbisch. That's all I wanted to say about that.
Question. Yes. In the thermofield double, we're basically purifying the state, right?
That's right.
So is there a way to think that what the Springer-Kalbisch is doing, is there a sense I can do the same there?
If you ask what's the Hilbert space of, I can consider this to be the action for some double theory with a doubled Hilbert space. And then the state thought about that way, the state that I'm working in is a pure state in that doubled description.
I see.
Okay. The goal for the rest of this talk is to deduce the symmetry constraints on Springer-Kalbisch effective field theory. So just what are the symmetries of the problem and how do we implement them? And the reason why I asked this question, and while I'll spend the remaining half an hour talking about it, because the answer is actually rather non-trivial. It's very different. It's much more intricate than in the usual Wilson effective field theory for the vacuum. One of the things that we'll find, actually, maybe the main punchline for this talk probably, is that, this is something very non-trivial, is that if my initial state is exactly thermal, then my low energy description is constrained by an emergent minimal supersymmetric quantum mechanics in the following sense. What I'll argue for is that there are two nilpotent symmetries that will arise in the low energy description of any thermal state. So Q squared is zero, Q tilde squared is equal to zero, and that their any commutator is minus beta H. So there's an emergent Suzy quantum mechanics along the thermal direction. Now, this is going to be a little funny, just to give you fair warning. This supercharge is going to be local, this one's not. And the other interesting thing that'll show up here is the following. In ordinary supersymmetric quantum mechanics, you have a charge conjugation symmetry, typically, that exchanges Qs and Q daggers. What will happen here, there is a symmetry that exchanges Q and Q tilde, and it's essentially the KMS condition. Which in this setting will act as an R parity. Okay, so that's where we're going. Let's get there. Okay, so I want to enumerate the symmetries of the problem. First up, not use that color. Is the green visible? Because I'm running out of orange. Is green visible in the back? More or less? Okay. Here's my Swinger-Keldysh partition function again. I have a Lagrangian, so I represent this thing with a functional integral. Then I have fields phi 1 and some action that I use to represent U1, some other set of fields phi 2 that I use to represent U2 dagger. Well, I can think of my action that I write down for my one fields and my action for my two fields as being formulated on different manifolds. In the context of thermofield double, you know, I could choose that my boundary metric on one side of two-sided ADS was different from my metric over here. So let me say that this part, I represent U1 as functional integral with an action written on a manifold M1 and U2 on M2. In order to be able to say something about correlation functions, I'm going to demand that M1 and M2 are diffeomorphic to each other. So, you know, they're the same manifold topologically, but I put different metrics on them, say, or different flavor gauge fields. And why do I do this? Well, if my original theory is diffeomorphism invariant, or in, you know, invariant under some flavor symmetry, then this combined thing that I write down will be invariant under independent diffeomorphisms over here and independent diffeomorphisms over here. So whatever symmetries I have in the problem are also doubled. So I have a double diffeomorphism invariance. If I have a flavor symmetry, some doubled flavor invariance. Now that's a little tricky to impose in effective field theory, or at the level of an action. So the way I'm going to deal with this is kind of dumb, but does the job. The picture is, here's my manifold M1, here's my manifold M2. If they're diffeomorphic to each other, then there exists a diffeomorphism that I can use to move fields from one manifold over to the other. I can pull back my one metric and write it as a metric on the other guy. And if I wanted to, I could write my action completely on this manifold, my partition function completely on this manifold. Something that I'm going to do instead for this talk is to introduce a third manifold that I'm going to call world volume, in analogy with string theory, where I have world sheets and target spaces. That'll also be diffeomorphic to both of these guys. So there's some maps that move me from here to here and here to here. And I introduce this guy mostly just to be symmetric. I don't privilege like the two fields over the one fields or so on. So I have maps x mu 1. I'm going to use coordinate sigma I over here. I have some maps x 2 nu of sigma j that map me from point here to point here. And then I write my effective action as some integral over the world volume rather than in target spaces. The other reason why I do this is the following. In our paper, something that we do that I'm not going to have the time to talk about here, we write down effective actions for dissipative hydrodynamics. And when one does that, basically the fields of the problem, one takes these maps from world volume to the physical spaces and promotes them to dynamical fields, complete with all the other symmetries of the problem. And those are the kinds of models that we consider. So in that sense, effective actions for dissipative hydro are sigma models. Anyway, so that's the first set of symmetries. If I go back to over here and I talk about combinations of fields, linear combinations of fields, average and difference combinations, well, what I mean by those really is I pull back fields to world volume, and then I can construct average and difference combinations here. So I can construct things like OR of sigma is pullback of my one operator to point sigma plus the two and construct it there. So that's really what I mean by average and difference operators and average and difference sources. Okay, that's the first symmetry that got to be imposed. That's the easiest one of them all. There's three others. The next one is much more interesting. So the next one is something that I don't think there's an agreed upon name for it yet. The name that has been offered has been to call it Schwinger-Keldysh symmetry. And this is the following trivial statement. The Schwinger-Keldysh partition function has what's called a topological limit. What I mean by that is the following. If I make my two sources the same as my one sources, so I make A1 equals A2 equals A, then the U2 dagger is the dagger of U1, and then by cyclicity of the trace, they drop out of the partition function. So in that limit, Z just becomes trace of the initial density matrix, and it's completely independent of the source A that you turn on. And consequently, correlation functions of the operators dual to these aligned sources, those correlation functions identically vanish. Now, what are those operators? Well, if I set one source is equal to two sources, I'm setting the difference sources to zero. So the correlation functions that are identically zero are the ones of operators conjugate to the R-type sources, and those are the A-type operators. So this implies that OA, OA are identically zero. Now that's a dumb statement. It's very simple. Derived it in a quarter of a line. But the point is that statement, while manifest microscopically, it's fragile in effective field theory. It's not protected by a symmetry. So what you can show is that for a generic action with two sets of fields that say the action vanishes when you set one field equal to two fields, you can show that at tree level, correlation functions of this type will vanish, but that loop corrections will generate them because it's not protected by a symmetry. So one way of dealing with this, I can't offer a proof that it's the only way, but what I'm going to tell you, this is a way to impose this property in effective field theory, is essentially via Witten's construction of cohomological field theory. And the idea is to, in addition to our fields, to our already doubled set of fields, so in addition to phi 1 and phi 2, we introduce ghosts. So we introduce two sets of ghosts. Let me call them phi g and phi g bar. They have the same quantum numbers as my original fields in my effective description, but opposite Grossmann parity, so they're ghosts. And I then demand the existence of a nilpotent symmetry, Q, with difference operators being Q of something. So I make all the difference operators Q exact, and then this statement follows from the usual statement that expectation value of Q exact is zero. That is by a localization. Well, a form of localization. Is this clear?
So phi g is associated to phi 1
and phi 2. No. Let me phrase it this way. What I can do is I can group phi r and phi g bar into a short supermultiplet. So q takes phi r to phi g bar, and then q annihilates phi g bar. And then I can group phi g together with phi a into another short supermultiplet. And then the phi a will, by construction, be q exact.
So the distinction should be exact only for this particular chain of sources, no? I thought that the correlators of the OAs are zero only for some particular chain of sources. Only when you...
Maybe I went too fast. The statement was that z, when I align my sources, being independent of that source, that is equivalent to the statement that correlation functions of A-type operators are zero.
So this is true in general.
Yeah. I guess I could write that. To make the statement one more time, if I align my sources, I'm setting my A-type sources to zero. And then the thing that I'm varying are the R-type sources. And those are conjugate to A-type operators. So that's how you get this statement. Okay. I have 20 minutes, so I better finish with the other conditions. This is, so we introduced ghosts. So we started off with, say, if we had a functional integral description, then we had one field, then we had to double to do Schwinger-Kaldisch, and then we had to double again to account for this. So now we've quadrupled. Thankfully, it stops there. There's no more further proliferation in this talk. The next condition that got to be imposed is the analog of the statement that the Wilsonian effective action is real. So earlier I advertised that Z star A1 A2 is equal to Z A2 A1. So that was the analog of statement that Wilsonian effective action is real. So this allows the effective action here to be complex. And the way it works is that the effective action, if I think of it as a as a functional of my various quantum fields, and then including the ghosts, and then also of my sources. This thing, complex conjugate, got to be equal to minus effective action with some transformation of my quantum fields, and then replace, well, exchange A1 with A2. That is to say, I can impose this condition at the level of the effective action with the discrete symmetry that does this. And what you can show is that there's several different possible definitions for how the quantum fields transform under this that we'll cover this. But basically, all those different conventions for what complex conjugation means in Schwinger-Keldysh, they're all equivalent to each other. And a suitable choice of writing this is the following. So I define my symmetry transformation to be capital Rho, which evidently looks like a capital P when if you write it in English. And what that's going to do is to send phi 1 to phi 2 and vice versa, and to flip the sign of the G bar ghosts, not flip the sign of the G ghosts, and yeah, that's all I'll say for now. So that is a suitable definition of complex conjugation. And if I might demand that my action, when I take its complex conjugate, gives me minus, and then think of the new fields, then I will have imposed the reality condition. I'm going to call this thing a reality condition. I should have said that. Then I'll be done. Now, at this point, let me do something to simplify my life a little bit. I said I'm going to group R-type fields and G-bar ghosts into short supermultiplets. Let me do that more efficiently by introducing a superspace formalism. So I'm going to introduce an anti-commuting coordinate theta to geometrize the action of this Q. I'll introduce a theta. And then when I say I group those things into short supermultiplets, what I mean is I define two types of superfields. One of them I'm going to call an R-type superfield. And I'll denote it with a bolded line. Phi bolded R is equal to phi R plus theta phi G bar. And phi, again with a double line, A is phi G plus theta phi A. And then that allows me to represent the action of Q as just a derivative with respect to theta. And then I can represent my effective action as a superspace integral, dd sigma d theta. And then, well, I can also define a convenient action of complex conjugation on theta. I'm going to choose it to flip the sine of theta. And then, so defined, what this does is this sends R-type superfields to themselves and flips this, and also sends, with these conventions, sends A-type superfields to themselves. So it doesn't do anything to superfields, but it does flip theta. And then the most general effective action, consistent with everything that's been enumerated on the board so far, can be written as a superspace integral. Well, first an integral over world volume, an integral over superspace with a Lagrangian that's a function of R-type superfields. A-type superfields, derivatives, bosonic derivatives, and then also fermionic derivatives, because fermionic derivatives anti-commute with the, well, they are the Q itself. And so this is what the most general thing that's consistent with Schwinger-Keldysh and the double diff and so on. And if I demand reality condition, then this thing, complex conjugate, has to be equal to minus itself with flipping the theta direction. And I can account for that by demanding that L is a real function of all its arguments, provided I put an I in front of d by d theta. Yeah?
Is it obviously you have the original action in this form?
Well, so in the original action, I don't have ghosts.
Right. So why is it invalid at the Q?
So why is it?
Why is Q a symmetry?
Why is Q a symmetry? So the statement.
Is it a symmetry of the original action?
It's not a symmetry of the original action.
So why is it a symmetry of the effective action?
Well, so what I think I tried to say it precisely in words earlier, and I'll try to say it again. So the statement, but it's worth emphasizing this point. We want for this to be true.
Yes.
That's the thing that we want to be true. And the statement is that for generic effective actions that I write down, not microscopic ones, but for generic ones, they won't preserve that condition. So how can I make sure that it, and in particular, how to say, so I care a lot about hydro. If I construct, I can use, so Pavel did this actually a little over a year ago. I can construct the quadratic Schwinger-Keldysh effective action for hydro, just knowing hydrodynamic response functions, like those that you would get, for instance, from a black brain. And that action is of the same kind, of the same type, that would generate correlations of these operators, not zero at loop level. So those kinds of theories. So it's not just, you know, some when I say that if I write down a general action that has cross-contour couplings, that will generate these correlation functions, I'm not just thinking of some extreme esoteric example. I mean ones that we care about, a non-vanishing set of theories. And then the statement is, well, how can I demand that this is preserved in effective field theory? And statement is, the only way that I know how at this time with cross-contour couplings is by introducing ghosts. Now, how that happens in renormalization group flow is a totally open question.
It emerges.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe there's a way to, I mean, something, well, yeah. From this point of view in this talk, it's an emergent symmetry.
Are you opposed to the idea of somehow imposing that symmetry in the
EV? No, I'm not. I mean, I'm not. But I'm trying to stick to things that I know with certainty.
I mean, I guess the quadratic term in the action will become bilinear in phi r and phi a, and then you could write it just as.
That's right. I mean, if I have free field theory, that's right. If you have free field theory, then you can add a completely decoupled sector of ghosts and have this symmetry already in the UV. But if I have like QC.
Perhaps you can systematically do polynomial interaction.
That's right. Our basic attempts so far with like QCD have failed, as my ghosts have to have the same quantum numbers as my original fields. So, you know, the ghost partners of my quarks would then be charged under the gauge symmetry, and then it's a little bit tricky to demand that they completely decouple from physical states. So, I completely agree. We would like to understand this from the ultraviolet rather than as an emergent symmetry of the low energy description. Okay. Good. So here's my most general action consistent with, well, how to say, where I impose, I demand this by introducing ghosts and introducing a Q. And I also satisfy the reality condition. So under complex conjugation, that acts by flipping the sign of I and theta. Flipping the sign of theta means my action goes to minus itself. And if it's a real function of all its arguments, I d by d theta is invariant, because theta flips sign and I flip sign. So this is consistent with everything in the problem to date. Now what I want to do to finish the talk, I want to specialize to thermal states. There's going to be one more symmetry that I got to impose for thermal states. That's much more complex than anything I've written on the board so far. And that symmetry is essentially the KMS condition. Which, if you've never heard those letters before, that's Kubo, Martin, and Schwinger. This last symmetry, my initial state is thermal, arises from the fact that my initial state then is the time evolution operator in imaginary time. That means that I can write e to the minus beta h, u to dagger as a functional of sources a2 of t. I can rewrite this as u2 dagger, functional of sources that are shifted in imaginary time. I think if I do it this way, there is a minus I beta. And that allows me to convert trace u1 e to the minus beta h u2 dagger to trace u2 dagger with shifted sources. Like that. This is not a symmetry yet, because the time ordering is different. Over here I have a u and a u dagger. Over here I have a u dagger and a u. So at the level of pictures, what this is doing is taking me from something like this to something like this, where I go back to 1. So I got to do one more thing. And the thing that I can do, I can use the CPT theorem. So in any unitary local relativistic quantum field theory, there's a CPT symmetry. And I can use that, insert it everywhere in here, and turn u's into u daggers and u daggers into u's. So CPT is anti-unitary. So actually what I'm going to use is the combination of CPT and complex conjugation. Get a unitary transformation. And the outcome of that is that the original partition function I can write as trace of u1 of sources that maybe flip sign under CPT, maybe not. So eta is plus or minus 1 depending on the source, a1, time reversed, and also reversed in space. This is whatever parity does. If my thermal state is just e to the minus b to h with no mu q, then it's CPT invariant. Okay, this is what you get after being extremely careful about factors of I and unitary and anti-unitary and all sorts of things that I don't even want to say how long it took us to unravel because it's embarrassing. So this is what you get. This is, you can think of as a KMS symmetry at the level of the partition function. It is, if you act with it twice, brings you back to where you started. So it's a Z2 symmetry. And the thing to impress upon you about it is that it's non-local. So it relates partition function with sources A1 and A2 to partition function with sources A1 and an A2 that's shifted in imaginary time. This is a non-local exact symmetry of thermal Schwinger-Kelish. One thing that it leads to without doing any work is that there's a second quote-unquote dual topological limit. So up there I said, you know, if I set my sources equal to each other, then I got my u and u dagger to cancel against each other. Well, here I can do the same thing. If I set my a2 of t to be a1 of t plus I beta, then If I consider sources of that type, then this trace just reduces to trace e to the minus b to h, which is independent of the source A1. And then there's a whole other set of operators whose correlations vanish. Those operators, let me tell you what they are. I have to do another change of basis. So I can define what I'll call tilded sources, which are A1 of t plus A2 of t minus I beta. And basically, my original average and different sources, but with the A2s all replaced with A2s of t minus I beta. These guys are conjugate to operators that I'll call OA tilde, which are O1 of t minus O2 t minus I beta. OR tilde equals O1 t plus O2 t minus I beta over 2. And these kinds of configurations correspond to turning off A tilde type sources. So this is this statement that there's this extra limit is the statement that correlation functions of tilde A operators all vanish. Well, if we're in a setting where the right thing to do is to have a Q and the ghosts, then I can define, I don't need to introduce more ghosts in order to accommodate this. I can impose this by introducing another nilpotent symmetry, Q tilde. This one's non-local. This is the thing that's brutal about it. Because the KMS symmetry is non-local. And rather than like writing down an algebra for the Q tilde, how it acts on fields and so on, what I can do is I can geometrize everything in sight and write down, I said over here my fields naturally group into short superfields. I can concatenate them, I can introduce a theta tilde that geometrizes Q tilde, and then write down long supermultiplets in terms of long superfields. Sure. I'll say what that is in a moment. I can do this. I'll tell you what R and A are in a minute. Q here acts on long superfields as d by d theta. Q tilde acts as d by d theta tilde plus I theta beta times d by dt. If you compute the anticommutator of those two differential operators, you find the statement I advertised before, that the anticommutator of the q's is beta minus beta h. Great, so what are r and a? Well, r and a are sick. they're not sick, they're ugly. There's a difference. So what we found was that in order to write down Q's which act as linear superdifferential operators, that is, Q's that respect the Leibniz rule, such that these A tilde type operators were Q tilde exact, what we found is that we had to make our superfields themselves non-local. They're approximately local in the gradient expansion, but they'll involve an infinite number of derivatives in d by dt. They involve fields at different points in imaginary time. And what we found was that we could have Q's that act as linear superderivatives provided that R and A were related as A over R equals the following thing. It's that. And what we demand in practice is that, at least in a gradient expansion, that is true. So our superfields become quasi-local at long distances, but really they're non-local beasts. So defined, I can geometrize the action of Q and this other Q tilde that I introduced to accommodate for this. And then I can write down in invariant actions that enforce this and this at loop level. That's great. There's one little bit more of the story that I don't have time to flesh out, which is that the KMS condition is a full Z2 symmetry. It implies this, but this is not enough to impose the full Z2. So in addition, I got to impose the Z2. And let's see how to do this. I'll use this board. So one way to impose that Z2 is basically to take any action that's a functional of these long superfields, which I write as a superspace integral. There's also another story that unfortunately I don't have the time to talk about, namely that there are superderivatives that you can write down that anti-commute with the Qs and therefore can appear in the effective action. So there's also a d by d theta and a d by d theta tilde. Anyway, we can enforce the KMS condition by basically just adding to the action the KMS conjugate of this guy. And the way that works, we can also define another long superfield, call it phi tilde. Which instead of having average and difference combinations as its bottom and top components have these tilded versions as their bottom and top components. And basically, so defined, and then I have to tell you, so there's where, and then there's also some relation. I define tilded ghosts, which are related to my original ghost by some linear differential operator. You can show you what it is if you really care. And then this KMS condition amounts to a Z2 transformation, which I can call K, which what it does, it exchanges these two different superfields with each other. And then basically I take whatever I have for my action, I add its KMS conjugate, and then the thing that I get is, it's kind of like if you want to get an even function of x, one way to do it is take any function of x that you want and then add f of minus x to it, and you get an even function. That's the idea here. But the last thing I want to say, and then I'll be done, is to say that this k doesn't commute with the supercharges. What it does, it exchanges the two supercharges with each other. So it maps Q to Q tilde and vice versa. More precisely, what it does is it sends Q to minus Q tilde and Q tilde to Q. And so it acts as an R parity. You can think of it that way. And this justifies the statement that I advertised earlier, that we find the this emergent supersymmetry where my supercharges are exchanged by KMS condition. This is what I had in mind. So at the end of the day, if you want to write down, what we find is that if you want to write down an action that's invariant under all the symmetries of the problem, and where we deal with these topological properties with a BRST-like formalism, then what one does, one introduces ghosts, one that has these Q and Q tilde, and then you also enforce an R parity. And the combination of all those things appears to be enough to impose all the symmetries of the problem. That's section 2 of our paper. what we do from there, you can use that those symmetry principles to construct effective actions for dissipative hydro and then for other more interesting things as well that I just don't have the time to talk about. So I'll end there. Thank you very much. Yeah.
So this theta, is there only one theta and one theta tilde, or are there some hidden indices that there?
No, there's really only, yeah, there's no alphas and alpha dots. There's no Cyrillic letters, there's no Hebrew letters. I should also advertise, so I said, we're building upon work by other people. Mukund Rangamani, as well as Loga and Felix Heil, have a formalism which differs somewhat from ours. It's rather interesting. I think at this point in time, it's not what they say ought to be true is that in addition to the two Qs that I've written down, that there ought to be two more, actually. So if you think about all this in the language of BRST, in BRST there is a there's an emergent other symmetry called anti-BRST symmetry, and in this setting, what they claim is true is that each of these Qs there's an anti-BRST that arises for each of them, and the four of them together generate something that's appear. It's this. N equals 2 super algebra of that governs this topological twist of N equals 4 that was written down, that was this particular topological twist was discussed in detail by Digraph and Moore, if I remember correctly. Anyway, I think it's not quite clear. So the whether or not one ought to demand those extra symmetries or not, there's not an argument from first principles at this time, whether or not there should be four Qs rather than two Qs. So in what I've presented today, I've tried to present the most minimal construction.
So if you have multiple recursors, do you expect you need to like increase the number of Qs and also?
Good, that's right. So the question is, if you make your contour more complicated, then what? So let me sketch out a little bit of this. I would have loved to have talked about this. So if here's your initial state, you go back, and then go forward, and go back, forward again. Say you did something like this. This would be trace U2 dagger U1. First off, why would you care about something like this? Well, there are correlation functions whose time orderings are not obtained from the Schwinger-Kalish partition function. So for instance, a correlation function that you might be interested in would be, say, O1 of t, O2 of 0, O1 of t, O2 of 0. These are the so-called out-of-time ordered correlation functions that have been used, that Kataev has argued recently, diagnose early time chaotic growth in quantum systems. Those, this kind of time ordering, you need a contour like this to compute them. So put this, say, at 0, t, 0, t. So what would you need to do to write down effective field theory of this partition function? Well, instead of doubling, you would have quadrupling. And then if you have ghosts, then there's going to be a proliferation of ghosts on top of that. And then the limits, the sort of there's going to be many more topological limits of that partition function than before. So let me showcase one such limit. Say I make my 3 and 4 type sources equal to each other. Then if I do that, this product is 1. And then I end up with U1 rho infinity U2 dagger, which is my original Schwinger-Keldysh. So if you set, and in fact, this happens pairwise. If I do that for U3, U4, if I do that for U1, U2, or U2, U3, if I do that for any pairwise adjacent U's, then not only does my partition function not depend on that common source, but my effective action, my partition function reduces to Schwinger-Keldysh. So my effective action ought to reduce to whatever Schwinger-Keldysh action arises without the extra segments of the contour. This has not been worked out by anyone yet. We're in the midst of trying to. I think Mukund Rangamani is also trying to do the same, maybe even others. It would be you have to do something like this if you want to have an effective field theory, like description of chaos and scrambling. Morally, one way of thinking about it, you know, there, in axiomatic field theory literature, they would say, look, why are you doing all this? Everything you can get, okay, they wouldn't say this, but maybe someone who read axiomatic field theory literature would say this. Look, if you have the Euclidean endpoint functions, then you can analytically continue them and get all the various time orderings possible by suitable I epsilon prescriptions. In practice, that's impossible, because we don't know how to do the analytic continuation properly. The way that I think about the Schwinger-Keldysh and these ones with the higher contours and so on, and this is kind of implementing that same strategy, but in a more pragmatic way. Notice that, I mean, if I wrote down an effective action for this partition function, it would be constrained by one where I only have 2 U's, and then one where I have no U's at all. So in that sense, you know, I can't have arbitrary effective actions with multiple contours for different time orderings. They're constrained by the ones that we've discussed.
Thank you very much.
Okay.